This episode is brought to you by Thorne, and I have some incredible news for any of you that are in the military, first responder, or medical professions. In an effort to give back, Thorne is now offering you an ongoing 25% off each and every one of your purchases of their incredible nutritional solutions. Now, Thorne is the official supplement of CrossFit, the UFC, the Mayo Clinic, the Human Performance Project, and multiple special operations organizations. I myself have used them for several years, and that is why I brought them on as a sponsor. Some of my favorite products they have are their Multivitamin Elite, their Whey Protein, the Super EPA, and then most recently, Cinequil. As a firefighter, a stuntman, and a martial artist, I've had my share of brain trauma and sleep deprivation, and Cinequil is their latest brain health supplement. Now, to qualify for the 35% off, go to thorne.com, thorne.com. Click on sign in and then create a new account. You will see the opportunity to register as a first responder or member of military. When you click on that, it will take you through verification with GovX. You'll simply choose a profession, provide one piece of documentation, and then you are verified for life. From that point onwards, you will continue to receive 35% off through Thorne. Now, for those of you who don't qualify, there is still the 10% off using the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, for a one-time purchase. Now, to learn more about Thorne, go to episode 323 of the Behind the Shield podcast with Joel Totoro and Wes Barnett. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show American Doctor of Radiology, Aziz Rahman. Now, as you will hear, Aziz just returned from a two-week aid trip to Gaza, and this is yet one of the many voices I've had from the men who have actually been boots on the ground during this conflict. So we discuss a host of topics, from his own journey into medicine, AI and radiology, what took him to Palestine, the immense workload on healthcare providers in Gaza, the lack of equipment, the deliberate starvation, murder at the aid sites, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredibly important and powerful conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single five-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 1,100 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Dr. Aziz Rahman. Enjoy. Well, Aziz, I want to start by saying two things. Firstly, thank you to our mutual friend Thayer for making this introduction. And secondly, I want to welcome you onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Well, thank you, James, for having me on your show. Dr. Ahmed actually introduced us last week, I believe. So the fact that you put this together so quickly, I really appreciate that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it needs to. And this is what we're going to take a deep dive into. So where on planet Earth are we finding you this evening?
I'm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I've been here for 6 years, but born and raised in Boston, Massachusetts, actually Worcester, which most people don't know how to pronounce, and they say Worcester or Worcester, like Worcestershire sauce.
Yes, which if you're English, is hilarious, just so you know that.
Yeah, I bet. You got that background. So how would you have said it if you didn't know it's Worcester?
Worcester is, we have Worcester in England. So yeah, it would have been the correct way, I would argue.
That's correct.
All right. Well, then let's start at the very beginning then. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings?
Yeah, so I was born in Massachusetts, one of five siblings. So I was the second youngest, two older brothers, one older sister, and then one younger sister. My mom and dad, you know, typical family. My dad was a doctor. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. She was trained as an engineer, but once she had kids, it just became too difficult to work as at the same time. So she basically did a lot of our raising. She would teach us pretty much everything after school. She would, you know, sit down with us before school, teach us math and stuff. So like I credit her a lot for my education, for my, you know, my work ethic and whatnot. So it was not just school that she wanted us to be good at, but, you know, extracurriculars. I was on the football team. I was on the track team. So she made sure we were well-rounded in that sense.
Now, were they American or were any of them immigrants at that point?
They were immigrants from Hyderabad, India.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so all my siblings were born in Massachusetts.
Okay. So I love, you know, again, we are a nation of such diversity, you know, and there is so much power in the immigration stories. As you were growing up or even conversations today, when they reflect back, you know, what were the beautiful things about Indian culture that they left? And then what was some of the, you know, the things that they are glad that they came to the US because of?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, America has always been the land of opportunity, right? So my dad did his medical training in India, but when he was given the opportunity to come to America to do his residency, his training, it was an opportunity that he couldn't say no to. So that's what brought him over here. And he was obviously married to my mom at that time, so she came over as well. You know, my dad was the oldest of his siblings, so he was kind of the vanguard in that regard. But my mom, she already had siblings here that had already come over to work for like IBM and some of these big software companies at that time. So some of the stuff that, you know, that left back behind in India, most of the culture, you know, the traditional wear clothes, the, you know, traditional family unit, which is super closely knit. They all kind of live on the same street, same village. And that kind of mentality where you could just go out, you know, and trust that someone's watching your kids, someone's going to be making sure that they know what your kids are at all times. And it was truly like the whole concept of it takes a village to raise someone, that kind of concept, I think they left behind there. And mainly because they just didn't know what society was here, right? So they were obviously very like paranoid about us. You know, but coming here, they had so many new opportunities that came up, just like any immigration story.
It's interesting. I had a conversation with an Air Force law enforcement veteran yesterday, and I always talk about, you know, when you're deployed, what were some of the beautiful things about the culture, you know, aside from the combat, obviously, the humanity. And he was saying that multi-generational household and the same exact thing, that it took a village to raise, you know, children. And you hear the struggles of a lot of people in the States now. You know, mom works, dad works, they can barely afford the daycare. And we've strayed away from, you know, arguably what was the kind of village dynamic all over the planet, which, you know, yeah, if you're a hunter or a gatherer or whatever it is, then there was a group of people that would help take care of the children while the parents had to do whatever. And now we've got so far from that, that, you know, even to the point where people have made a good point, you know, now that you've got two incomes, that way double tax being paid, you know, is there a pull from, you know, that side that's actually making both members work? Because it is, it's near impossible now, yeah, for a lot of households, yeah, to take care of their own children.
Yeah, no, I'm very cognizant of that. And I'm very grateful that, you know, my dad was able to support the family with his income. Granted, I will say even he had difficulty with five kids going to college. I mean, that's very hard to afford. I would say almost impossible for anyone to afford. So, you know, I completely understand that sentiment. And unfortunately, it's far too common that even if one of the family members wants to stay at home and take care of the kids, it's just not feasible sometimes. You know, property taxes are too expensive. You know, just income is not really rising with inflation levels, groceries, all in everything. Just everything has gotten so expensive that it's become a challenge for many people.
Absolutely. Another thing is people ask me, you know, will they make fun of the British food? And I tell them, well, you know, one of the most popular things in British food is Indian food.
Oh, yeah.
We eat, you know, so much, and it's hard to find good Indian food in some parts of America. So that's another thing I'm sure that, you know, that a lot of people miss if they, you know, find themselves away from Indian culture, is simply the amazing cuisine that you guys have too.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say fish and chips, but but that's true. Yeah, Indian food is really big there. I haven't been there, but I've heard. I definitely want to visit and try the local foods there.
Yeah. Well, I've said this a lot. If you go, you know, when I was young, I'd go to Heathrow Airport and it's all cultures, you know, Africans, you know, South Asian, Southeast Asian. I mean, just from all over the place. And it's just this beautiful tapestry of humanity that comes through. And some are visiting, obviously some are on holiday, but there's a lot of people that is part of the UK, you know, and I think that's the upside of colonization. I mean, there was a lot of darkness to it, but now, you know, we have this beautiful diversity in Britain, and that includes obviously cultures and cuisine and all the things. So, you know, the kind of fake projection that the UK is this kind of Aryan nation could not be further from the truth.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's true. I mean, if you go to places in the Middle East or India and Pakistan, like you'll find the population to be so uniform that you kind of miss, you know, back home in America or Canada or UK, because truly they're melting pots. And the fact that you see all the different ethnicities, backgrounds, makes you a better, in my opinion, a better person if you can, you know, if you're not racist. But because you get to learn so much, you get to experience how to deal with different people. And I think that just gives you so much more, you know, emotional intelligence and just the ability to really be flexible with people.
Yeah. And I've said this, you know, when you deviate from a shared humanity, then differences become a threat. And what should happen is that we should see the humanity within each other, and then the differences become nuances and they're interesting. So, you know, the moment that you just put someone in a pigeonhole, you miss that experience of actually, you know, being interested in their culture.
Hmm. Yeah, I like that.
What about then career aspirations? You mentioned some of the sports that you did. What were you dreaming of becoming when you were in the high school age?
You know, I think we all had the same, you know, athlete and astronaut, you know, growing up. I played on the football team. I wasn't good enough. I wasn't good enough at basketball. Just kind of made it on the team, but that's it, you know. So sports wasn't like something I would actually pursue, even though I loved it. Kind of was between law, engineering, and medicine. Medicine because my dad, and I have three aunts that are doctors. And so growing up, you know, it's kind of one of those things like, oh, I don't want to be a doctor because my dad's a doctor and my aunts are doctors. I want to do something different, you know. My engineering because my mom was an engineer. And then lawyer, I just thought would be kind of cool because they're all smart and can, you know, have to deal with so many different types of things and people, right? They're very people smart. And so I kind of like that about the law profession. But as I grew up, went through high school, I kind of realized, you know, what I was good at. And I was good at like sciences, I was good at biology, I was good at physiology. And that kind of just stuck with me. And then my mom, she was really pushing me to medicine, to be honest with you, because she's like, it's one of those fields where you're helping humanity. And, you know, you're going to enjoy it regardless. And at that time, you know, I was like, oh, my mom just taught me what to do. But I took my mom's advice, and you know, looking back on it, I'm very grateful I did.
What was your father's specialty?
My dad's internal medicine, which is just the standard doctor, so to speak, who takes care of the patients in the hospital, like, kind of like the quarterback of the hospital. So he works at a rehab hospital in Boston, which takes care of some of the sickest patients coming out of Massachusetts General Hospital, which is one of the biggest hospitals in Boston.
This is always interesting to ask, you know, as we look at the health of the nation now and we see the corporate side of medicine and, you know, like, for example, there's a great opportunity to underline this, you know, we have this pandemic where the health of the nation, certainly there's a great opportunity to revisit that and be like, what are we doing wrong? With 70% of our country is obese or overweight. And so the kind of preventative, proactive side doesn't seem to be taught in medical school specifically by a lot of people I've had on the show. When you reflect back now from the training that you had, how much training was there on, you know, diet, nutrition, sleep, some of the pillars of health that we know now?
Yeah, that's funny that you say that, because I went to school in Kansas City, Missouri, and the medical school I went to, University of Missouri, Kansas City, was actually what was pumping out a lot of family medicine doctors. So they were pretty heavy on primary preventive care, and I would say I had quite the opposite experience where we were really, you know, advised to push our patients for better diet, better lifestyle choices. Granted, this was like, you know, I graduated medical school in 2013. So things definitely have changed over the last decade. But yeah, back then we were definitely going to rural America, teaching them, you know, dietary changes, just, you know, trying to maintain good lifestyles, cessation of smoking, just the basic things, you know.
So when you go through this training, you know, period, were there any kind of aha moments once you got out into the real world, you know, treating actual patients?
Yeah, that is, I think every physician who graduates medical school has to go through that, right? You go to residency, you go to fellowship, and then you're always under the protection of your attendings, you know, your bosses, your the faculty of physicians who are kind of hovering over you, making sure you're not going to make any mistakes, making sure you're making the right decisions. And any lawsuit that comes through, they're kind of protecting you. The hospital system's protecting you. And then the day you graduate, you know, and you start taking care of your own patients, you've done something 1,000 times. And it's just like, man, this first time by myself is a different experience. You know, you just become nervous, you're sweating bullets. And it's truly a gargantuan task. And that lasts about 6 months to 12 months before you kind of get back into your confidence levels that you need. But yeah, I think the fact that, you know, there's no one watching over you at that point, and patients are kind of relying on you to the point they even ask you, like, how many times have you done this before? And you're like, how do I answer this question?
Do I look that nervous to you? What about the residency? You know, when it's been interesting, as I've really taken a deep dive into the world of sleep medicine, realizing that that's one of the massive underlying issues in my community, I've started learning about all kinds of things. And the backstory of the surgical residency that used to be these insane hours was this one, I think it's William Halstead, if I got the name right. And he, you know, was known to be up for hours and hours, that days and days. And so that kind of became the norm. And I think we're talking about the beginning of last century, but turns out that he was a heroin and cocaine addict. So I'm pretty sure, wow, I could pull some benders too if I was coked out of my mind. So
that's one way to stay up.
So the way that we've always done it isn't necessarily the right way. I mean, you know, the children used to work in factories and go up chimneys back in the day. How was your residency experience? And again, have you seen that evolve from, you know, the crazy stories of a few decades ago?
Yeah. So my dad, like I said, my dad was a doctor. He was training during the time where there was 48, 72 hour calls. I mean, it's just insane. 2 to 3 days in the hospital, not seeing your family. Obviously it takes a, you know, emotional toll. It takes a mental toll. It takes a physical toll sleeping in the hospital. There's no sunlight coming in there. And sometimes if you're in the radiology department, especially, it's just like, it's a dungeon basically. So, you know, when I was in residency, there was no strict rules about times except for a new 24-hour rule. But not everyone followed that rule. I luckily had a good program director that followed the rule to the T, and he was actually more of an advocate to the residents than anyone in the hospital. And it was awesome. He was just protecting us in every way, shape, or form. If he had any trouble, he would, you know, speak up on our behalf. And I can't forget him. He's just been such a inspirational leader to me. And just the way he led this program of almost 50 residents, he treated us like his children, just wanted us to succeed, wanted us to really work hard and learn the most in the 4 years that we were in residency. So, I mean, I had the blessing of saying I wasn't abused in that sense, you know. That said, I do think some specialties took advantage of it and, you know, really worked the residents to the ground. I mean, I think those residents are probably better than what's happening now, which I think is the opposite extreme, where I would argue that some residencies are just not giving their residents enough hours and just not making it hard enough. You know, it's going in the opposite extreme, in my opinion.
What made you choose radiology as a specialty?
Yeah, radiology to me was a means to get into interventional radiology. So interventional radiology is a specialty that not many people know about, but they say, you know, if you're ever hospitalized, you won't be discharged until you meet an interventional radiologist. And the interventional radiologist does minimally invasive procedures through imaging. So you have to be a radiologist to use that imaging, to understand that imaging, to read that imaging, to be able to do the procedure. And that's why I did radiology. It was a means to get to this really techie, advanced specialty that we kind of abbreviate IR, interventional radiology.
So would that be using contrast and those kind of things so you can see, you know, blood flow and issues within the body itself?
Exactly. So I'm sure you know what an interventional cardiologist does, right? They put stents in the heart for people who are having heart attacks. So I imagine the interventional radiologist is the doctor that does everything outside of the heart. And we also do different types of interventions, whether it's biopsies, drainages for abscesses, cancer treatments, all through minimally invasive means.
Amazing. I had someone on the show a while ago that was talking about AI, and the conversation initially was that the radiology, you know, profession might be threatened by AI as far as reading x-rays, etc. But then they were saying, well, no, it's not like that. It's more of a second opinion to make sure that, you know, we don't miss anything. So we can let AI, you know, read as well, and then we can compare and contrast, and it's better for the patient. What has been your experience with this developing technology?
Yeah, I think AI is more powerful than we give credit to. And it probably can do a lot more than we expect it can, especially as these, you know, the way AI is developing lately, it's not linear, it's like exponential. So yeah, I do think that it's going to be something I'm going to be looking out for in the next decade. We're starting to use it in my institution right now. And I could see the value, but it's also scary because we're basically teaching our own enemy. Basically, it's going to take over, you know, they say it's going to take over our jobs. I don't think it's going to take over our jobs, but I do think there are going to be fewer radiologists required, because the AI, one radiologist can read five times more with that AI helping him or her. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. It's funny, when I did stunts for years, and I worked in the Terminator 2 show. So all these conversations about Cyberdyne and all that stuff, like, I used to play that. And now here we are, you know, and there's robots and there's drones and there's AI. And like, oh, okay, this is getting faster than I thought. Next thing, we are going to have, you know, Cyberdyne systems and robots chasing us around. So
I hope not.
All right. Well, then shifting away from that. So we've gone through your career. Talk to me about, again, the backstory when it comes to, you know, you advocating for the Palestinian people. And, you know, if you want to, again, as we discussed before we hit record, if you want to even give some backstory, some context before we talk about your journey to Gaza.
So I'm a Muslim. I practice my faith pretty religiously. And I respect people who follow their faith or their principles pretty faithfully, because I think we live in a time where it's hard to find principled approaches. And to me, that's the main thing. People who have morality, people who live by principles, people who really value ethics, to me, that's kind of how we should aspire to be, essentially. And it doesn't necessarily mean you have to be a Muslim or a Christian or a Jew. There's atheists who have better morality than some Muslims and Christians and Jews, you know? So that's not what will get you to the point of caring about humanity, is my point. I think just growing up, justice was also a big thing to me. I told you I always wanted to be a lawyer before medicine. And then even in medicine, like, just being a just person is so important, as you're being sometimes berated by a patient or a patient's family. Just how are you going to deal with that anger? How are you going to deal with that trauma that they're dealing with? And, you know, we get trained up during medical school how to deal with difficult situations. And I think part of that just helps you to kind of focus on morality and justice and ethics. And, you know, as time went on and I got older and started reading more about politics, I just realized, you know, what kind of world we live in. Obviously, then I started having kids, and now, you know, thank God I have three kids. And I'm just realizing, like, I want my kids to see me as someone who stood up for humanity at all times. You know, I want them to be proud of me. I want them to live in a world where it's difficult to find what's, you know, right. And so I want them to have someone that they can look up to and trust.
So was this something that really spawned out of, you know, the reaction to October 7th, or was this prior to that?
I mean, it goes prior. I don't think the Israel-Palestine conflict is what, you know, sparked my morality to, you know, really speak loud. I think, you know, coming from India, for example, my parents talked about some of the experiences they had. You know, like when my grandfather talks about his stories of them having to flee to Pakistan because, you know, there was some conflicts in India happening. So it happened to them too, you know, just having to leave as refugees and then go to a new area and establish a new life. And, you know, it definitely didn't start October 7th. It's always been there. And as you, you know, then you read about what happened in Bosnia, you hear about what happened in Burma, you hear about, you know, what's happening in Sudan and in the Congo. And it's just everywhere, you know, you just see injustice everywhere. You see violence everywhere. And it makes you wonder, like, what is behind all of this, you know? And I don't think it's a single answer. I think it's very complicated because evil is not, you know, is multifaceted. But yeah, I just couldn't just stay silent after what we saw these last, you know, year and a half in terms of numbers, in terms of the videos coming out. I mean, we can't deny the fact that this is the first live stream mass killing. And I myself will say the word genocide as a physician who actually experienced it firsthand, as you'll get into. But yeah, I just couldn't take it anymore. It was just too much violence that I was seeing firsthand on my phone, which I've never actually seen before.
I've used this example with you know, a few people that have come on the show talking about the same thing. I grew up with the IRA bombing the mainland. And, you know, again, if I look back in the history of the conflict with, you know, Britain and the Irish, again, it makes no sense. We're all the same people, you know, full stop. But, you know, you can see the kind of origin story of the oppression, but they were bombing the mainland, you know, shopping malls and those kind of things. And when October 7th happened, which was horrific, and a lot of innocent people were killed, I know some of the stories were exaggerated, but a lot of innocent people were killed regardless. It to me was like, you know, a mainland bombing by the IRA in the 1980s, you know, because I literally have to sweep under the car with a mirror. We were right next to a military base when I was young on my farm.
Wow.
And so that would be like the British then going in and destroying the entire city of Belfast. And the rest of the world wouldn't tolerate that. You know what I mean? So this is where I started going, okay, what the hell is going on? Is initially there was a reaction to October 7th and be like, oh God, this is awful. You know, this conflict that's been going on for so long, and now there's even, you know, more innocent people being killed. But it didn't stop, and it got worse and worse and worse. And then, as you said, you know, depending on your ability to lean into humanity, or whether you were politicizing one or the other, whatever it was, the numbers became irrefutable. You know, when the number of children that were killed were in the tens of thousands, you know, now you can't say that's collateral. You know, there was a point where it really crossed a moral threshold, and you realize that the reaction to it was not, you know, a military response. It was far different than that. So that's when, you know, Thayer and Alan Shabaro and some of these people came on early, because I was disgusted. Because as you said, as a human, as someone with empathy who does a job where you literally would die to try and help someone, how can you look at that and not go, that is wrong, full stop, end of story? So as you're watching this, you know, at what point did you start seeing the inequity and this was a different response? And then kind of walk us through what made you decide to actually get on a plane yourself.
So October 7th, I feel like people really don't know what was happening before that. And I know this gets people in a lot of trouble to talk about, but the reality is, there have been so many October 7ths in the world and in Israel-Palestine conflict on both sides in the past, you know, decades. So I truly felt October 7th was inevitable. You know, and we know October 7th like the back of our hand at this point, that day. But, you know, between in Iraq and Iran, there's like 200 people bombed in a mosque. You know, that doesn't become a date. In Pakistan, you have conflicts happening all the time. You know, 50 people bombed, children and women killed. That doesn't become a date. So obviously, just being in the West, we have this media that's pushing this conflict more than other conflicts. So that's one point. Another point is just in the Israel-Palestine conflict. I mean, it really doesn't take much digging to understand that this has been a decades-old conflict. And it really does not start on October 7th, no matter how much the media will tell you. Just read up on yourself. I mean, it's really not challenging to open a book, open up a website, and nowadays ChatGPT or one of these other AI agents, you know, just ask and figure it out yourself. And you'll come up with the same conclusion that many others who have researched it come up with. I'm not Palestinian, but I like to do my own research. As a physician, you know, we're always taught primary evidence, you know, what evidence-based medicine, what decision did you make that decision off of? What paper did you read that allows you to give this medication over that medication? You know, why is that procedure indicated in this patient with this disease? You know, you look at the papers, you look at primary evidence. So to me, I've always been like that. I've always liked to go back to the sources and really see what's going on. I don't really take what people tell me at face value unless I see it myself, right? So, and I think that's important to some extent. I think it's important to trust people too, don't get me wrong. But you have to trust the right people.
Absolutely. So what, again, through your eyes, and there's all these back and forth. Like I said, it goes back. I actually saw, and this was a, you know, Instagram post. So again, I'd have to take a deep dive into the history, but it was like the 1910s that some British, I forget, it was an Earl or someone, you know, was given the ability to actually dish out Palestinian land to, I forget if it was specifically Israel or if it were other people too. But I mean, so, you know, my forefathers, you know, the damage that's been done through colonization. I mean, you can just keep going back and back and back and back. And there's the origin story becomes another origin story. And, you know, like Afghanistan, you know, you've got our conflict and you go back and it's the Russians. And then, you know, there's this, you know, it never ends. So at what point did you realize that post October 7th, this was different though? This was a different response now. And then talk to me, like I said, about, you know, what made you decide to say, all right, I'm going to go over there. I mean, even though we're talking 2025 now.
Yeah. So I knew there was going to be an asymmetric response after October 7th. That said, I did not expect, you know, what we're seeing now. I really did not expect this full all out genocide by almost all accounts, except legal. So I'll just, what I mean by that is, you know, International Court of Justice is the only organization that can legally make that binding decision that this is a genocide. But NGOs, physicians, people, you know, who experienced it can, you know, non-legally say that it's a genocide. So I truly do. But, you know, at that time, I was like, oh man, so many people are going to die now. You know, Israel's going to really do their, I think they have something called the Dahiya Doctrine, where they have something called asymmetric retaliation. And so I knew that they were going to, you know, do something along those lines. I didn't know what, maybe 1,000 people die, 2,000 people die, but it just kept going up and up and up. And it just every day, every week, every month just got worse and worse. And the pictures coming out just got more disgusting and it just didn't stop. And you just see the progression just, you know, unstoppable. And we're like, okay, the UN's going to stop it now. And then you see the UN Security Council, you know, didn't go through, the vote didn't go through because America said no, and every other country said yes to a ceasefire. And then, you know, you hear about negotiations happening. Oh, there's almost a ceasefire. Oh, and then there's a ceasefire. So you get happy, but then it got broken. And it's just like, you know, at what point is this, you know, how are the civilians going to get through this, you know? And it came to a point where I was like, man, I wish I was a trauma surgeon. I wish I was a ER physician, because I would go over there and help, you know? And I, you know, I say that to myself, but I don't know if I actually would have at that time. But then someone actually reached out to me who had gone. He was an orthopedic surgeon. And he's like, hey, this opportunity might come up where you can actually go. Are you interested? And for me, it was like, absolutely no doubt. I didn't even consult my wife or anything at that point when I said that to him. Obviously, I knew I would have to ask my wife and my mom, my dad. But to him, I just said, absolutely, like, tell me how I'm going to get there and we'll take the next step, you know, we'll figure it out.
So walk me through that then.
Yeah, so I was actually on a plane back from like a medical conference in New Orleans, and I got this text from him. I was on the in-plane Wi-Fi, you know, nowadays. I got this text from my good buddy who's an orthopedic surgeon. We went to medical school together. And he's like, hey, you know, this opportunity came up. Are you interested? I said, absolutely. Like, tell me the details. So I landed, and it was nighttime. I told my wife, hey, let's put the kids to sleep and let's go have some coffee downstairs at night, you know, which usually means like we need to talk about something. And so she's like, so what's going on? And I was like, oh man, this opportunity came up, and it's an opportunity of a lifetime. And I don't know how to tell you. And then she just interrupted me. She's like, it's Gaza, isn't it? And I was like, yeah.
Thank God.
And she knew. She figured it out because I had just been talking about Gaza. To me, it was one of those things. I can go to work and treat patients and have a nice lunch and have my latte. But not talking about Gaza just felt empty. It was almost like I'm enjoying my life while people were being annihilated over there, you know, on the daily. I just felt odd. So you can ask any of my colleagues. For the last year and a half, I just bring up Gaza. I'm like, hey, you guys following? What's going on? Like, you know, what do you think? I just try to make conversation about it.
How was it received? Because it's been interesting at the beginning. You know, I mean, I even had my social media account closed, and supposedly it was for copyright, but there was no warning, nothing. It just all of a sudden went away. The appeals never went anywhere.
Wow.
And you know, I was again not even like putting a lot out there, just as a human being saying this is wrong and having guests and, you know, sharing, you know, videos if it was pertinent. And, you know, even, you know, the British, like, you know, my home country, the BBC, there was everything. If they were talking about Gaza, was Hamas led, and then it would go to the thing. And then, you know, here we are with America, and we're literally arming, you know, this genocide. We are providing the weapons for it. So I found it disgusting early on, the apathy, the lack of courage to stand up and say, this is wrong. And it's not anti-Semitic to say this is wrong. A lot of Jewish people are disgusted by this. This isn't in the name of the religion. This is a certain group of tyrants that are doing this for money and power, not for the greater good of their religion or their culture. And so it's great to see it shifted now, but it took so long. It was just nauseating, the lack of courage, you know, for so long. So, you know, when you were talking about this early on, what was the reception with your community at the time?
I actually had difficulty getting to people. The first week I myself was like, oh man, I don't know how to respond to this. Like, what's going to happen? You know, because October 7th, you know, there's nothing you could say. And then a week after that, I think it just became clear. Like, you know, I think it was a week or two, you know, there was already 1,000 civilians dead, a lot of them babies and kids. And it just became clear. Like, that in itself would have been enough, right? Like, let's stop now. But I just kept going. So at that point, at a point where I just realized, like, okay, it's getting out of hand, is when I started talking. When to me, it was clear. Even though at that time it wasn't clear that the beheaded babies news was false, even though the alleged rapes was false, and we found that out later by legitimate sources, I couldn't defend that because I had no primary sources to defend it. So at that time, I was just trying to focus on the civilian death that was already happening at that point, which was in the thousands. And I just said, hey, like, you know, if we lived in the time of the Holocaust, we say we would be on the right side of history. We would defend the oppressed. We would speak up for the voiceless. I definitely would say that I would do that, right? But if given the chance, would I actually do it? And to me, this was it. Like, I'm going to speak up for the oppressed. I'm going to speak up for the voiceless. And I'm going to share these people's stories to my community. To the point, I think maybe in November, as a Palestinian in our community, we asked her to make some sweets, like baklava and whatnot. And I took it to work, and I sat everyone down, and I used the opportunity to kind of explain the conflict and the history, 1948, 1967, and how that resulted in October 7th and to what's going on in Gaza now. And at the end, I said, the person who made this is a Palestinian, and she had one request that I share with you while I'm talking to you. And they're like, what is it? And they said that Palestinians are humans too. And I just, that was it. That was my message. And they just start crying, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's the problem. You know, when you create a boogeyman, you dehumanize. And then you hear so many of the veterans that have been on here. I ask about, you know, the atrocities that, you know, not tell me the worst thing that you saw, but, you know, some of the lack of humanity in some of these war zones where they were protecting the, you know, the local people. And I talk to them about kindness and compassion. And, you know, the way that they talk about the Afghan people, the Iraqi people in certain areas, they're like, yeah, they were beautiful. You know, we'd go in and the dad would be fixing the car and mom would be making dinner and they'd, you know, always offer us food. And it could have been, you know, Baghdad or it could have been Detroit. I mean, it's the same exact thing.
Yeah.
But what's happened here is, you know, the boogeyman, Hamas, October 7th, October 7th, to the point where even though there's all this footage of children being pulled out of rubble, you know, and screaming parents holding their limp toddlers, but that still would not break through the politicization that was being sold to the people. And if you dare have any empathy, then you must be a bleeding heart liberal or whatever the term was. And so, I mean, it's turning now, but it was disgusting to see. And I've said this comment, you know, my grandfather fought in World War II. Those incredible men and women said, I'm going to do something. This is wrong. And yeah. Where is that voice now? They would be disgusted in our
generation. Absolutely. That's a good point.
So you got this text, you've had this conversation with your coworkers. How does that lead you to actually flying over there yourself?
So I was really scared that I would be denied. So there's about a 75% rejection rate at the Jordan-Israel border to get into Gaza from doctors. So I really didn't tell anyone except for one coworker. I have like 20 partners at work, and I told one of them who's in charge of scheduling, and he knows how passionate I was. So I called him up and I said, hey, man, something came up and it means everything to me. And I need 2 weeks off, like two additional weeks off, you know? And he's like, oh, man, like, I know if it means that much to you, just consider it off, you know, which to me was like the most amazing answer I could have heard at that point, because I was really scared he wouldn't give me the time off. And then I was like, man, he's so nice. And I had to share, you know, so I told him about the possibility of going to Gaza and how I need to get some medical supplies and how I'm not sure if I'm going to be let in. So if I'm not, I'll come back to work immediately. And at that point, I just had some consultations with my mom, my dad, my siblings, some really close friends to see what their opinions were. Some doctors that I know had been to Gaza before this conflict and during the conflict. And I just got many different people's opinions. And at the end of the day, I just realized, like, man, this is a conversation I need to have with God and see what's in my heart. And I know in my heart, I want to go. I want to help, you know, the woman, the children, the elderly, the men, the fathers. And it came to a point where I was just like, even if I go there and help one person, I'll be happy. And that was kind of my decision.
So what was some of the supplies that you were trying to get over there?
So I'm an interventional radiologist. It's kind of a techie, resource heavy specialty. It's not like a trauma surgeon where you just need a blade and some sutures. And it requires infrastructure. It requires an x-ray machine, a fluoroscopy machine. So I was planning on doing trauma cases, some cancer cases, some pediatric cases, and some women's fibroid cases. And so I had to get the proper equipment to do those cases while in Gaza. And the way I knew I needed to do these procedures is I got into contact with one of the local interventional radiology doctors in Gaza. There's only two in the entire population of 2.1 million. Just for comparison, in Houston, the population is about 2.3 million, I believe. There's probably, you know, 200-300 interventional radiology doctors in Houston. So two. It's just not enough, right? So when I told them I was coming, they got really excited. They told me, oh, we need this, we need that. We'll try to set up patients for you. So they actually brought patients to their clinic before I even got there and said, we're going to set you up with this American doctor who's coming and he's going to do your procedure in two months. And so they were really excited, you know, because there's cancers being ignored there. There's pediatric diseases that's being ignored there. And there's women's diseases that's being ignored there because the trauma is just overwhelming the hospitals. And there's no one to focus on the chronic care issues.
So I've heard, you know, several people talking about the problems at the border, whether they're being turned away completely, whether equipment's not allowed through. You know, you get on this flight, you land, kind of walk me through the ability to actually even get across.
So from Chicago, you take a flight to Amman, which is about a 12 to 14 hour flight. You stay in a hotel. So you have to be there the night before you're scheduled to entry. So you get there at night or whatever, the day before, and then you get an email 12 hours before your scheduled arrival into Israel, okay? And you basically get an Excel document that has your name, and it's either green or red. And so if you're red, you just fly right back home. You can't do anything. Or you stick around in Jordan and just kind of enjoy Jordan. But if you're green, then you're good to go. So I would say 22 of us applied to this trip. Some people got some denial letters. Six of us got in. And even when we were in Amman, some people had just landed and they were going right back. One guy was from the UK. He was actually an Egyptian who, you know, he's a citizen of the UK and he's an ENT surgeon. So he felt really, you know, he was just devastated. He had all this medical equipment he was planning on bringing in. He was in contact with some of the local ENT doctors. So before he left, he came up to me and was like, "Hey, man, can you take some of this with you and give it to some of these surgeons that I was supposed to meet up?" And so I agreed. He was a better packer than I was. So I took some of his gear and he helped me sit on the luggage so I can fit more stuff in. And that's it. So once you get the green light, you know, you go to sleep, you wake up really early in the morning. There's a bus waiting for you that takes you to the Jordanian border, which took us about 4 hours, 4 or 5 hours to get through. And then there's a bus that takes you from the Jordanian customs to the Israeli customs. That takes about 30 minutes. And then you get off the bus and then your bags have to be rechecked. You have to be rechecked on the Israel side. That takes about 3 or 4 hours. And then now at this point, there's a separation. Some of the Palestinians are going to the West Bank. Some of the Israelis are going to Israel. And then the NGOs and physicians are going to Gaza. So it's like a trifurcation. So those of us who are going to Gaza are waiting, all of us to meet from different organizations to be done with security. And then there's an IDF, Israeli Army convoy that takes all the buses from the NGOs into Gaza. And that's about a 2-3 hour drive from the border to the Gaza checkpoint. And we entered through the Kisifim checkpoint. So by the time we got there, it was nighttime. And I remember as our bus was going into the Kisifim army checkpoint, all you could see, it was really eerie. It was dark. You just see these really high intensity stadium lights kind of illuminating this parking lot. In the distance, you can see some tanks parked. You can see just soldiers with their weapons on them. And we sat in our bus for an hour. And then they told us we can switch over to the Gaza buses. So now the Gaza buses came and we get off and we take our luggage and go from one bus to the other. And then we sit on that bus for another 2 hours in this parking lot with just soldiers kind of monitoring the situation. And then after 2 hours sitting on that bus, then we're given the green light to actually go into Gaza. So if there was no borders or checkpoints, 3 hour journey from Amman to Gaza took us about 14 hours.
Crazy. And were there any issues getting the equipment across?
Yeah, so that's a good question. We were lucky in that we got a lot of our medical equipment in. We took some ultrasounds. We took some, I told you I'm an interventional radiologist, so I took some of my equipment in. My colleagues also did. Our main thing was just bringing in food. We went in June 2025, and the starvation problem was really just taking off. And obviously now it's July and August and the situation has just got exponentially worse. So yeah, as of June, we were really just trying to bring in, you know, food, high protein kind of things, peanut butter, baby formula. And so we got lucky. I will say we were team 36 for the organization we went through. And we told team 37 to bring in baby formula. And team 37's baby formula all got confiscated. And I actually asked why to some of the physicians who were on that team, and they were told that it's too much and it has to go through the health ministry if it's that much.
This is when, you know, literally we've seen the videos that the children are starving, infants are starving to death, and you are turning away baby formula.
Yeah, it's not that I saw videos. I saw the baby starving myself with my own eyes. Us as Team 36, we thought if there's one thing people will have humanity for, no matter how much people hate each other, it's babies, right? Premature babies at that, in incubators. And so we went to the pediatric ICU and talked to the local, you know, ICU doctors. And we're like, okay, we're going to do this. We're Americans. We speak English well. We're going to get baby formula into Gaza. And we did our best. You know, some media picked us up, and I thank them for that. And we got a big social media push for baby formula. And then we were disheartened when we learned that Team 37's baby formula all got confiscated. So that was pretty frustrating.
So you're going there, as you mentioned, it was dark. You know, talk to me about what you saw, especially, you know, when the sun comes up as far as, you know, Gaza in June 2025.
So as we enter Gaza with our local Gazan bus driver, we drive away from these soldiers and this super militarized checkpoint that basically is this entry between two different worlds. On the back of us, we're leaving Israel, and in front of us is Gaza. And we all know what we're going to see, which is absolute destruction. Problem is, it's so dark, it's hot, really hard to see anything. So all we can really see is what the lights of the car illuminate. And for it's dirt roads, there's no asphalt anymore. It's all been torn up by the tanks and whatnot. And as we're looking around, we're really trying to see everything we can see. Our adrenaline's pumping, and we just see, you know, rubble, buildings destroyed, neighborhoods demolished. You could see almost like kids' toys between floors of the concrete, just, you know, like a seesaw, like, you know, really colorful blue and red toys that are just like between the rubble. And we can't see it that well, but you can kind of see where it's making turns. And on the ground, there's like food. There's literally this like sacks of rice and flour that have been burst open. And so we asked our local Gazan driver, like, what is this? And it's like when the trucks come in, some of the food falls off, and anyone who tries to get it will be shot. So these are what we call red zones, that humans are not allowed to go in the red zone unless explicit permission has been given by the Israeli military. So that's how we were able to travel on this road, because we were waiting for the 2 hours to get a green light from the Israeli military to be done with their whatever mission they were doing at that time.
Was there any fear amongst you and the people that you're traveling with, just based on the fact that, you know, the ethics didn't seem to be followed in so many cases? And we've obviously, you know, one of the big ones for us, my community, was all those firefighters and paramedics that were executed not too long ago. You know, what was the fear mitigation? Because you're going on the trust that the Israelis are going to do the right thing at that point.
Yeah. So again, there were six of us, four Americans and one Jordanian and one Algerian/French. So I was the most optimistic, I would say. And I was like, they're not going to kill an American physician. It would make zero sense for them to do that. And everyone else was more like kind of historic and realistic in that they're like, well, it's happened before. The Al Jazeera American journalist was shot with a sniper. The World Food Program NGOs were targeted with the drone and they died. And, you know, there's been a lot of international people who have actually died. And there are always obviously some logistical mistake that comes out. So I was like, yeah, I mean, we could die with the mistake, I guess. One of our colleagues, he was going back and forth, should he pay for like an extra life insurance policy, which was like super expensive. Eventually, we just convinced him to do it because he was talking about it for so long. And no, but the fear was real. I think I was just a little bit overly hopeful that nothing would happen.
So you're seeing Gaza kind of unfold through headlights. You know, what was the difference the next day when you had daylight to kind of, you know, reveal the magnitude of it?
Yeah, so the bus took us through the rubble, through the roads to a camp called Mawasi Refugee Camp. It's basically where one third of Gazans live. It's in Khan Yunis, and the hospital nearby is called Nasser Hospital. So we weren't allowed to go straight to the hospital. We went to a safe house with our NGO. And again, it's nighttime. We can't see anything. So we were dead tired. So we went upstairs into the apartment. They gave us some food. They apologized for not having their genuine, authentic cuisine. They basically just gave us hummus and pita bread. And it was so good, you know, just having absolutely nothing. That was so delicious. And we went to sleep. We woke up around sunrise, and then we looked out the balcony, and it's just tense as far as you can see until the ocean, you know, the Mediterranean. You look left, there's tents. You look right, there's tents. You look forward, there's tents up to the sea. You see some kites in the air, and that really surprised me. You know, kids are going to be kids. They're going to always try to have fun. I thought that was kind of beautiful. I looked down, and that's the main road, which is basically a dirt road. And there's donkeys pulling, you know, equipment here and there. There's cars, but some of the cars are not working, so the people are pushing the cars. Yeah, you just see people kind of waking up and looking for something to do. You know, some people are going to work at the hospital, which is pretty much the only work left. Everything else, I feel like, is just like almost volunteering, trying to clean up. So yeah, the scene was really amazing. Hate to use that word. As an American who's never done a medical mission before, who's never really seen this kind of destruction, it was truly eye-opening. And it took me a little bit to understand what was actually happening. And in the distance, as we're looking out, still sunrise, you kind of hear bombs in the distance about every 30 minutes. And it was very odd, you know, it was very odd just not knowing what that meant. And that's my first time ever hearing a bomb.
They had talked about the systematic demolition, and you said about the roads, for example, there's videos of, you know, them literally being dug up to remove the infrastructure. We know that, you know, hospitals are targeted, schools are targeted, you know, which again, when you're looking at the Geneva conference convention, you know, is completely against all ethics anyway. You've got this mass of tents, you know, were you able to see the just, you know, the absolute destruction of the Gazan city itself?
There was no city. That's what was sad for me. It's like I wanted to see what the Gazans lived like before. And if you look at pictures, it looks like any other American city. There's buildings, there's roads, there's flowers, there's architecture, there's, you know, there's restaurants, there's shawarma shops. You know, you look at those pictures, there's mosques, there's churches. And then you look at outside the balcony, it's just tents, you know, tarps. And I'm not talking about tents that you get from Costco or one of these fancy tents. You're talking about just, you know, four sticks, four metal poles, and then some sort of a sheet that connects them, you know. And the only thing between your neighbor and your family is the same sheet that belongs to you and them, you know. It's not even two sheets, it's one sheet. And I just realized, like, holy moly, I can't comprehend this. I know this in my head that third world countries are third world countries, but this was just hard to swallow and know that people were being killed even in these tents, which is a green zone. You know, there's not supposed to be any killing in the green zone.
One of the things that really stuck out when there spoke the first time was he went to Jerusalem first, and he said there he saw, you know, Jews and Muslims and Christians all praying side by side, and he said everyone was getting on. And then you go through these massive checkpoints at the time, and, you know, I think it was Rafah that he went when he was there. And he said, you know, it was a completely different world. And that's what's so mind-blowing, is that, you know, that humanity existed outside of these gates. And then, you know, here you have these Palestinian people that are just being, you know, eradicated, their homes, everything. It's kind of like some of the World War II stories. And when the most recent book I wrote, there are examples where they literally killed every man, woman, child, demolished all the houses, and even rerouted the river that used to go through the town to remove any essence of that. And that seems exactly what's going on here.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that's the scary thing, is that history repeats itself. And I think I heard someone saying something that really stuck with me, that one thing we learn from history is that we don't learn from history.
Absolutely. And it's, I think this is the thing, even if you look, let's go back to our country for a second, the deliberate division, the deliberate fear mongering, the, you know, removal of books, you know, all these kind of things, it's lending to that. And, you know, the reason behind all the atrocities in history is a small group of people that crave, you know, power and money. That's it. slavery, yeah. You know, you name it, any horrible thing that's happened in our history hasn't been an entire country saying, oh, we're all on board with this. It starts with a few horrendous human beings. And then you add apathy in and fear mongering. And all of a sudden, you know, this is allowed to happen. And here we are again in 2025, you know, only 80 years after, you know, for example, we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, which is another horrendous event. So we are not learning. And then when these things are happening, we're not just not learning, we're turning our head, which is even more disgusting.
You know, I think yourself, James, and probably many of the soldiers, the Marines, the firefighters, the police officers that you've interviewed, and many of your other guests probably are the type that if they see an injustice happening on the street, they're going to step up. But majority of the population is just going to walk right by. And there's a phenomenon where the more people watching an incident, the less likely an individual is actually to help if there's like someone dying on the street in the park, you know? And so that's kind of how I feel. Like the world, everyone knows what's going on, but very few people are actually willing to step up to the plate, talk about it, you know, do something. And I feel like that's where we are in this world, not just with the Israel-Gaza conflict, but everywhere, you know, within it's in our own backyard. I feel like there's so many differences within people nowadays, but I still hold on to my old school principles. If there's something wrong with someone, I'm going to help them out. And I feel like that's so basic. That should be our baseline humanity.
Absolutely. Well, you talked about seeing kind of like the 10,000 foot view as far as the sprawling tents. Let's talk about the people now. What did you start seeing, you know, when you started treating people? And then let's talk about the starvation that's going on as well.
Yeah. So we got to you know, after sunrise, we ate breakfast. Again, they fed us food that they don't have. Like they actually just sacrificed their meals for us, you know? And we didn't really comprehend the situation on the ground that first few hours. In retrospect, I wouldn't have eaten. So we got to the hospital in the morning, and they're giving us a tour, kind of explaining where we're going to stay. We're going to stay in the call room for the next 2 weeks. There's a guy's sleeping area. There's a woman's sleeping area. There's a common area. We get food. We can hang out. We can watch some TV. There's a balcony that kind of has a nice view of everything going on outside. And, you know, then we introduce ourselves to the local doctors and we find out what we can help, where we can, you know, involve ourselves. And one thing I realized is the doctors there are so tired. They themselves don't have anything to eat. The responsibilities are so intense. Like it's not just taking care of your patients. Right after you take care of your patients and you go home, you're going home to a tent. And it's your responsibility as a man to go find food. And then it's your responsibility as a man to find some firewood so that you can go home and your wife can make some food for the family and kids. And so, you know, and the next morning you brush off the sand off your head, your hair, your clothes, and wear the clothes that were drying on some, you know, line on the tent, and then come back to work and rinse and repeat every single day. And work there is so much more intense than what we know as work. For example, in the ER, some of our local ER doctors that came with us, they were like, oh, we're going to do 8 or 12 hour shifts, right? Oh, we'll do 12 hours on, 12 hours off. That's kind of the standard here. The local just laughed. They're like, you won't last 4 hours. It was almost like, okay, let's challenge this, right? We have this like American mentality where we can work our butts off. And so, yeah, it was true. The intensity of the trauma was just too much. Physically too much, mentally too much, emotionally too much. It was awful. And the only way I can describe it to you is take the worst trauma center in America in terms of the, you know, sheer volume of patients, and then multiply that by like 100. So, and I mean that, I mean like literally multiply that by 100 in terms of the patients coming in. In America, we have our mass shootings here and there, you know, and it does happen, but not every day, you know? And that's where it just takes this mental toll that makes no sense. And so, you know, it's Saturday, Sunday is the day one and day two that we're there. The fire alarm goes off in the ER. And that's our first experience, what we call them MCI, mass casualty incident. And it basically is just it tells everyone in the hospital, hey, any physician who's available, come down to the emergency room. There's a mass casualty event. and we need all the help we can get. Okay. So we go down there not knowing what to expect. And there's already just hundreds of patients littered on the grounds. And I'm not even exaggerating. You can go on social media and search Nasser Hospital MCI, and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. There's not even a place to put your foot between patients without your boot or your shoe getting bloody. And, you know, your family member is just in chaos trying to figure out where their family members are, where their children are. You have doctors trying to figure out, you know, which patient to see next. And it's just like, there's no, you know, there's no like way to understand what you're supposed to do. So you just go down to a patient, you see if their heart's beating, you see if they're breathing, you move on to the next patient. And it's just this assembly line. And that goes on for about 4 hours. Okay. And at the end of that 4 hours, you just want nothing to do with medicine anymore. You just want to like sit back and just look at the sky, take a deep breath, and wonder what the hell's going on here.
Well, I think that's the thing, you know, with my profession, with your profession, if we have some massive event like that, yes, the initial hospital, the initial responders, you know, are going to be overwhelmed for a bit, but there are more people coming, local departments, other hospitals, you know, the military, you know, the federal response. But in this case, none of those people are allowed in. So, you know, the people that you're working alongside, and please correct me if I'm wrong, those are the only people that are there to treat people.
Yeah, we are not, we didn't go there to say we're better physicians. We went there to give the few physicians who are there some respite, some relief, like you said, because there's no one's coming to relieve them, you know? There's no special forces, there's no backup units, there's no on-call physician that's going to save the day. It's them. They have to work their shift without food, without, you know, clean drinking water. There's no AC in there in summertime. You're sweating your butt off. It's awful. And you know, we were lucky in that we had our snacks in our bags upstairs, so we could just go and take a break if you wanted to, right? But the locals didn't have that.
What about the spectrum of patients that you were getting? Again, the message we've had for a long time is, oh, this was a Hamas, you know, combatant, Hamas combatant, but that doesn't seem to match the videos that were, you know, coming out. So you had a perfect, you know, boots on the ground perspective. Were these military age men only coming through, or was it a spectrum of ages and sexes?
Yeah, so I always wonder how to answer this. So first of all, we saw zero combatants. I don't even know how you would define a combatant. Are they wearing military relief gear? Do they come in with a weapon? Do they come in with a knife? Like, what defines a combatant, right? And then number two is everyone we talked to was coming from the aid sites, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, GHF aid sites. And that's where majority of these mass trauma incidents were coming from. And then outside of that, we were seeing patients who were being shot getting water, who were being shot getting sitting in their tents by quadcopters. So back to your question, I don't know how to answer from a legitimately point of view. How do I answer that question that was this patient a Hamas person? I have no idea. How would I know? Right. But no, there was no indication of combatants of Hamas in the hospital.
Well, I think, I guess the other side of that question, the reason I'm asking that is from the videos, you know, we're seeing infants, we're seeing toddlers, we're seeing, you know, elementary school ages, we're seeing elderly women. So you're telling me that all those were members of Hamas? Like, of course, you know, if there is a resistance, there are going to be people amongst that that may be part of that. But if you're talking about over 20,000 children now, how can you turn around and say, oh, but Hamas? Like, no, there's a certain point. So that's, you know, that's from the boots on the ground. As far as, I'm not talking about some of the men, but I mean, you know, were you seeing all this, you know, these innocent civilians? And I would argue at least, you know, no one can argue that a young child and maybe an elderly woman is not going to be a Hamas combatant. So that alone, you know, debunks that whole myth.
So I would say, let's just say, for example, one of the MCIs, 400 patients came in over that course of that MCI. I would say 15% approximately were children, 15% women, 10, 15% elderly, And then the rest of the 55% men. Okay. Now within the men, you have very young men and then you have elderly men, right? And that's the thing. I don't want to say that I feel like our Western populations, our Western colleagues might think, oh man, they might be Hamas, you know? But dude, these guys were just getting food for their families. If you were in Gaza, you would be getting the aid. You're the strongest male of the family. You are going to walk 10 kilometers to the aid site and you're going to take that 25 kilogram bag, which is 55, 60 pounds, put it on your shoulder, walk another 10 kilometers back. You're the young man of the family. You're going to do that, right? So I feel like we don't do it justice just by saying children and women and elderly, because guess what? The men are all just men like you and me, just trying to make a living. They're trying to survive. They're trying to feed their families. We can't just all lump them as possible combatants and as a statement like that. So that's what kind of bothers me when people kind of even ignore the men, because they were the ones, 55% of the ER was loaded with young men trying to get food for their families. And we say, oh, but you know, they're not as innocent as the children, or they're not as innocent as a woman and elderly, you know?
Yeah. And I agree. I think the example again would be, let's go back to Belfast. You know, we're flattening the entire city. Well, that's the mechanics and the doctors and the accountants and the teachers and the firefighters and the police officers, none of whom are IRA members. So I agree 100%. But for me, it's like, even if you pretended that every single, you know, military age male was Hamas, which it makes no sense whatsoever, it still doesn't excuse all the other things. So to say, oh, it's because of this, it's like, there's no way. That does not make any sense. Of course, there are resistance fighters. Of course, you know, some horrible things are done, you know, by Hamas as well. That's, war is disgusting. And, you know, like I said, I experienced that, not personally, but, you know, on you know, my homeland when I was growing up as a young boy. And the Irish people experienced horrible things on their side too. So I think it's just more to make the point that, you know, I think it's great that you've underlined that, because this is the reality that of all those men, you know, most of whom are just trying to simply, you know, keep that roof over their head and try and forage for some food for their family.
I can't tell you how many young men came in with their family members and they stopped when they saw us American doctors and they're like, oh, can we have a selfie? And then we asked them, like, where are you coming from? And they say, oh, the GHF aid sites. And, you know, in my head, I'm like, oh, I wonder if he's telling the truth or not. So I asked them straight up. I was like, dude, do you have any pictures of while you were there? Yeah. And a lot of them took selfies with the American soldiers, the mercenaries. And I was like, dude, isn't that dangerous? They're like, oh, it's dangerous if you do it with the Israeli army, but with the Americans, they're pretty cool about it. So I thought that was really interesting. And in some of them, I even keep in touch with today. And to me, that was just proof. They're just normal dudes. Trying to bring food home to their family, and they're at the hospital because one of their loved ones just died, you know? Yeah. But, you know, I actually asked a lot of people on the ground. They told us not to talk about politics while we were there, but I just couldn't help myself. But I asked a lot of the people, I was just like, you know, what is the story with Hamas? Like, what is your opinion? And I'll tell you, just like in America, if you asked, you know, some political question in America, you're going to get an answer, a different answer from everyone, right? So similar to there, I got a different answer from everyone. Some people absolutely hated them. Some people said that what happened October 7th was the wrong decision. Some people said they're gonna support them through and through. Some people said that, you know, it was inevitable. It had to happen at some point anyway. So it just happens to happen. It happens during our lifetime. I mean, you got every answer. And I thought that was kind of interesting just to see what the local population thought. And I think at this point, people actually support them as a resistance more than anything, just because they basically have no more hope. They're like, well, we might as well die trying, die resisting. We're all going to die anyways. And I can get into that, but I would say 100% of the population there is depressed. Majority are probably suicidal. And I've talked to many healthcare workers there who actively told me they're suicidal on a very private conversations. And, but they follow their faith to the level that they would never commit suicide, but they have thought of ways they can, you know, increase their chances of death. And you know what the answer was? It was to go to the aid sites to try to get food. If you got the food, great. You get to bring back food to your family. But if you die, it's almost like a suicide in a way, you know?
So let's talk about the starvation first, and then obviously I really want to get to the, you know, the atrocities that are happening in what's supposed to be a safe zone for the civilians to find their food. As you mentioned, June was kind of the beginning. So obviously, you know, with your journey through medicine, you know what a healthy child, you know, man, woman, et cetera, looks like. And you know, malnutrition, for example. What were you seeing at that point with your own eyes?
So I have to back up a little bit. So it didn't start in June. I would say it mostly started in March. And that's when the GHF took over from the UN agencies that were essentially banned. You know, they've been providing aid in third world countries for decades, since World War II, basically. And in Israel, they've been, I mean, in Gaza specifically, by Israel, they've been banned. And this new distribution scheme headed by private military contractors called the GHF, it's a joint venture between Israel and America with our tax dollars helping prop this up. You know, this is the aid distribution mechanism that has been established in March. Now, it's not bringing enough food, and it's feeding a very select population. Basically, the healthiest men who can get there, who can walk 8 to 10 kilometers and back, right? And maybe, for example, I don't know the exact ratio, but it's like, imagine 10,000 people trying to get food for, and there's only 1,000 boxes, right? So there's just not enough food to feed even all the people that are coming there. And there's only 3 or 4 aid distributions in all of Gaza. And prior to that, there was about 400 UN aid distribution sites. So we're talking about just impossibility. Now, to answer your question, starvation doesn't happen overnight. You probably know this because you've probably been through survival training as a firefighter. But, you know, you can't live without water very long. Maybe a few days to weeks at max, you know. But food, you can live pretty long without food. I'm not saying it's healthy, but you can go months, weeks or months without food. And truly, I think this is all engineered starvation. It started in March, knowing that's really not going to kick in till July, August. You know, we're talking 3-4 months. And that's what we're seeing. So in June, we started to see where people were passing out. People were, you know, having hypovitaminosis, anemia. You could see it in their skin. Their energy levels were just sunken. The kids have no emotions. They're just tired. They don't even cry. And you're starting to see it, and you're like, something's happening here, you know, but people aren't dying yet. And then July came along, and then you just started seeing a spike. If you look at the chart, it's like in March, 1 or 2, April, 1 or 2, you know, June, 3 or 4, and then July was like 60, you know? And I don't, the August numbers obviously are not out yet because it's August 7th, but I'm really afraid it's going to be like 150, 200, because it's not going up like linear. It's going up like a logarithmic, you know? Until something drastic happens, that's going to get worse and worse. And we're going to be talking about very high rate of death because we're in what we call IPC category 5. And it's like international criteria for food insecurity. And we're in stage 5, which is famine. And what that means is in a population, that's 2 deaths per about 10,000 people. So if you extrapolate that up to 2.2 million people, that's about 500 deaths a day. And the problem with feeding a population who's already in famine is you can't just give them a T-bone steak and call it a day. Then they're going to have something called refeeding syndrome from a medical perspective, where their electrolytes just don't know how to handle this rush of nutrients and food to the point your body just goes in shock almost. And it pushes the electrolytes into the wrong places. And then you have, you know, cardiac arrhythmias and you can die. So now we're dealing with the population that's not only starving to death, but even giving them aid might actually kill them. You need nutritionists, you need physicians, you need coaches. We're getting to a point where this is, in my opinion, all engineered to really come together, kind of where we are now in August, July, August, September. And I don't see a solution. Is what I'm concerned about. You might call me pessimistic, but just the way America's responding, just the way Israel's responding, just the way every other in the country in the world is not responding, I'm really scared to see what happens next year.
When I was young, there was this amazing children's show called Blue Peter, and I've talked about it a few times on here. Like, the television was phenomenal. You know, it really was. And Blue Peter would talk about, you know, famines and things that were going on in the world. And then they would literally get all, you know, the young people, the school kids, to figure out to do fundraisers. And so we would raise money, and obviously hopefully that would go and help with the feeding over there. Now you're seeing these images, which again are very similar to the Holocaust images of the starvation that's gone. Even the, you know, as you said, the aid workers, the doctors, you know, they're gaunt as well. But this isn't, you know, a weather incident. This is literally a group of people that are being enclosed while there is, you know, bountiful amounts of food on the outside of these walls. So this is what makes it so disgusting, is there was a solution, you know. And I think what I'd love to hear about is, you mentioned the GHF sites. There's this kind of projection, like, oh, we, you know, we're providing all this food. And again, you know, Hamas has taken it, or, you know, whatever the excuse of why it isn't getting to the people. Now, again, you've been on the ground. You've been talking to these people that are there. Talk to me about these sites. You mentioned, you know, how few there are in the first place. But are there just tankers of food, you know, being held by, the, you know, Hamas or whatever it is, away from the people? Or is it set up to seem like aid is being given when it's actually not?
So aid is a very complicated topic, and I think it's worth talking about here. So there's a GHF aid, okay? There's only four sites of distribution, and all of these distribution sites are in what you call red zones, or militarized zones by the Israeli army, to the point if anyone with a gun or a weapon were to go there, that drone would just smack them dead in a millisecond, you know? There's just no way. And there's a drone flying overhead 24/7 while we were in the hospital. And I'm sure that's everywhere in Gaza, but we were only in Khan Yunis. And yeah, there was not a second in the day that there wasn't a drone buzzing overhead. On top of that, there's tens of thousands of people who go to these GHF sites. And while you're there, there's military contractors from America, there's Israeli army, there's drones, there's tanks. To say that Hamas is going there to steal the aid basically just means that the Israeli army and the American mercenaries are incompetent, that Hamas can just come, take the food and steal it from everyone, from the 10,000 people. It's not logistically possible. It's not logistically feasible, even if you believed in that. Right. And, let's say one Hamas person was there and he took some food for himself and his family. Is that Hamas stealing aid to the point that you starve, you know, the rest of the population? No. On top of that, the GHF sites are not bringing in as much aid as you think. We actually saw one of the convoys coming in as we were leaving Gaza. It was about three 18-wheel trucks. You know, you see that on the highway, three trucks. Great. You know, that probably will feed 1,000 to 2,000 people, right? And so that's not enough food. It's a joke. It's a show. So there's something else we need to talk about. So that's a GHF. The other thing is there is some aid coming in that's not GHF, and that is still not enough. It's just not enough trucks. We're talking about 500 aid trucks needed per day, at bare minimum, according to the UN, before the war. Okay. And we're talking about like 10 trucks a day now, you know, three from GHF, seven from non-GHF. For example, I'm making up numbers, but it's this small, you know. Now, the problem with these trucks is that in order to get into Gaza, they have to go through military roads, Israeli army military roads. And who gets first access to these trucks in these highly militarized zones? Well, you might, I don't think many of your audience members might know this, but there's what we call internal gangs in Gaza. And these gangs somehow get access to the aid before anyone else in these militarized zones that Israel is keeping a close eye on. So you might wonder, like, how the heck are they doing that? Well, it turns out there's a lot of media that's reported on this, that these gangs are actually Israeli-backed internal gangs. So they're basically sellouts in Gaza that through whatever means that they're selling out to their brothers and sisters in Gaza, they're willing to help the Israeli army, whether it be financial gains, whether it be a promise of security, whether it be a promise of exile in the future. They're basically looting these trucks, taking majority of the food off, and then selling it in Gaza at extraordinary prices. Okay. And any of the local police in Gaza, and when I say police, you know, people's heads might be like, oh, that's Hamas. No, well, it's still a society that's trying to function, you know? So now at this point, they're probably voluntary police. So they try to protect these convoys, but they can't. And if they have weapons, then they'll be struck with a drone. And this has happened multiple times. So now you have these gangs, and the main one is Abu Shabab. So Abu Shabab, he, I believe, was a ex-Fatah member or a non-Hamas before the war. Some people say he has ISIS links as well. And his family disowned him publicly. They put a social media post out there. His entire family basically said he is not of our blood anymore and his blood is halal, meaning like anyone can kill him and that's retribution for what he's done to the Gazan population. So that's the other part of it that no one's really talking about. It's this Israeli-backed gangs that Israel's using to take advantage and create more chaos, create more inflation, create more difficulty, create more starvation, and it's a perpetual. It's just getting worse every day.
Talk to me as well, and you kind of touched on it with the MCI. You know, we've seen the videos, these people that do make it to these aid sites that are then being, you know, literally executed while they're trying to get food for their families.
So I was never at the GHF sites. So my evidence, and I told you I'm all about primary evidence, is secondary evidence, right? I wasn't there. But what I will tell you is we talked to all the family members through translators, through our fellow doctors, what is going on out there? You know, where did you come from? What does the GHF sites look like? What's happening? Are they actually shooting at you? Like, why are they shooting at you? Why are they shooting tank shells? You know, et cetera. It's just, we are asking everything because we ourselves are journalists while we were there. We didn't recognize the fact that we would go there as doctors, but we would also be journalists, humanitarianists, friends, psychologists. I mean, we were so much more than just doctors. And as a journalist, I think it came to a realization that once we realized there's really no journalists on the ground anymore, we had to take it upon ourselves to get the story straight. And here I am talking to you, and I give, you know, I thank you so much for giving me this opportunity, but I'm conveying to you through secondary evidence that the GHF sites are civilians going to get food. Some people get it, some people don't. And they have to basically coral themselves into these little narrow walkways, one in and then one out. And then on their way in and out, they're hurried in and hurried out by gunfire. And I don't know if they shoot directly at them or shoot next to them, but the point is everyone said there's gunfire everywhere. And it's just chaos, you know? And then you see the social media videos and then you hear some testimonies that are coming out now and you kind of putting the pieces of the puzzle together. But it's interesting because we're hearing accounts of what's happening at the GHF and then we're receiving it at Nasser Hospital Trauma Bay. And it's like this puzzle piece. It just fits. It's so perfect. But I guess that's still not enough evidence for people to believe international doctors.
I mean, it is. I literally struggle to even comprehend it. I really do. But I believe there is a shift finally. Too little, too late. Absolutely. But there is a shift happening. Even the BBC now, everything is definitely reporting what's going on in Gaza rather than, like I said early on, Hamas this, Hamas that. So kind of walk me through the end of that. I mean, arguably deployment. And then, you know, what was your homecoming like after being immersed in that for a few weeks?
So, you know, I feel like I should just touch on one part of my deployment there that really hit me. Is there perseverance? Is there smiles? Is there humanity? Is there friendship? Is there hardworking ethics? Their love for education, especially medicine. Medical students to the residents, they just wanted to be taught lectures and pretend like there's a normal life out there. And I just thought that was so fascinating that these people who are going through annihilation just want me to lecture them about a medical topic. Just didn't make any sense. You think they just want to go home and spend time with their family, but no, they have a whole different outlook on life. I don't think we can understand. So that's one of the things that like keeps me happy is just the memories I have with them, you know, the positive moments between the traumatic moments. And we were all in it together. You know, we came in as Americans and we were the same humanity that we're expected to have anywhere in the world. And I think that really showed. A lot of the people turn around after we pronounce their loved one dead, say, thank you for coming here from America, from your comforts of your home, from giving up your family to be with us. And, you know, I'm not about self-promotion at all. Being a doctor is a very, you know, thankless job, and I'm okay with that. I'm completely okay with that, right? But I've never felt more gratitude from others than being in Gaza. People were thanking us so many times a day, even after we pronounced their family members dead. They knew we tried our best, you know? And there's really the resources there are just awful. We didn't even touch on that, but the resources in Gaza are just minimal in terms of every kind of medical specialty. But yeah, so, you know, eventually it was time to come home. And that date was kind of looming on us. We almost didn't want to go home because we're just like, this is so pure. This is so, you know, this is medicine. And we felt it. And we haven't felt that in a really long time. So as we were leaving, it was very bittersweet. We were very happy, very excited to see our family soon, our babies. Some of us had 6 months old at home. Some of us had 5 months old. There was one doctor who had a 2 week old waiting for him at home. 4 week at that time. So he entered with a 2 week old. And yeah, we were excited, but it's just we're leaving our brothers and sisters behind. That's what it felt like. I don't know if I'd see them again. I keep in touch with them, but I would have no idea what will happen to them.
How did you begin the process that when you came home? Because you talk about moral injury, even in my career, I think one of the most crushing things when you're in, you know, a service profession, you know, medical profession, is the inability to save. And you're out there, you know, with, you know, such limited resources and just overwhelmed by the number of people that needed help. And then you get on a plane and you find yourself back in the States. And as you said, the creature comforts that you were used to and with your healthy children and healthy wife, that must have been jarring in a way. So how have you been able to navigate that so far?
Yeah, that was hard. I landed, 14, 15 hours later, came home. My 5 month old at that time was so chubby, you know, he had fat rolls all over his arms. I was just like, wow, like, I don't know. I'm happy, but I wish I could give some of that fat to those kids, you know? And then my 9 year old, my 6 year old was so happy I'm home. They're like, Baba, when you get over Gaza, like, can we play Mario Kart? And I just like, in my head, I was like, can't get mad at these kids. Like, it's not fair, you know? But I was so upset. I was just like, so upset that they said that. So I was like, you don't understand what I just saw. You know, you don't understand what I just experienced. And, you know, talking about playing Mario Kart just angered me. And I looked at my wife and I was like, I need to just not say anything right now. But, you know, it took me maybe a week to get back into things. I think I kind of just slept everything off. It's not that I slept it off. I think I just handled my emotions through sleeping. And now I'm putting things more into action than I thought I would. I didn't really know what I would do when I came back, but I find myself being a lot more vocal about what's going on there than I ever have. I'm just not scared anymore. You know, before people will label you this, label you that, saying, hey, this is too political. Hey, this is not something we need to talk about at work. And I'm just like, dude, I'm a doctor. If people are dying, it's relevant, you know? I don't care where it is. I'm talking about it, you know, and my job is not to be annoying, but just to raise awareness. And like you said, the world is waking up. Unfortunately, we have leadership in every country that just still hibernating to going the opposite direction. But I truly think Americans are finally like, okay, something is majorly off here and it's our tax money that's doing this.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it is, but I feel like it just started 2-3 weeks ago.
I agree. I think there's literally the beginning of what I've called a renaissance of kindness, compassion, and empathy. I think we've strayed so far from, you know, who we are as Americans. And even if you subscribe to, you know, Islam or Christianity or Judaism or whatever it is, even there, you're like, well, wait a second. You know, would our prophet actually turn their head to these atrocities. Of course not. Of course, they'd be the first person, you know, acting. So I think, you know, there's the cracks to the foundation are really starting to show now. And I've, you know, something I've said everything from this to, you know, even in my profession, as far as lack of leadership is, there's a lot of cowardice. You know, we beat our chests and we, you know, get all googly eyed over guns and, you know, muscles, and cowardice is standing up when it's an unpopular conversation. I mean, sorry, it's not standing up. Courage is standing up when it's an unpopular conversation.
Yeah.
And cowardice is allowed to thrive and becomes, you know, tyranny if you just let it perpetuate. So I think that now people are starting to see through the lies, and then hopefully there'll be a groundswell of, you know, support in the right direction. So with that being said, you know, if you were king for a day and you could wave a magic wand, what were the things that would need to change so that we could reverse this?
Yeah, I think it's dialogue. I think it's just communication. I think it's love. And I know these sound so generic, but, you know, I don't think the Gazans hate Jews. I don't think the Gazans hate Israelis. I think if they were given a chance to coexist in a single state where everyone's democratic and everyone has the same rights, I think they would get over the genocide. I think they would just try to start a new life. Because I think at this point, people are just sick of it. They just want to live. And but they want to be given an equal chance, because they've been living in this, you know, apartheid concept for however long they were born. And I think it's time that we get over that. You know, colonialism is so old school now. It's like, why do we still have this concept going on in 2025? I truly think if I was, you know, like I was given that magic ability, I would just tell people, like, figure it out, you know, figure it out, stop the killing. And, you know, just like two siblings, you know, they're going to fight, right? But as a parent, you tell them, figure it out. I'm done with your bickering. And I feel like Trump, you know, he has that power. He really does. And I'm not trying to get political. I'm not going to talk about Democrats, Republicans. But truly, you know, we can't argue that Trump is the most powerful man in the world. He has the power to stop this overnight. Actually, when we were in Gaza, the Iran-Israel conflict was going on. And then 12 days later, it just stopped, you know, because Trump told it to stop. And everyone was just like, why can't that happen for Gaza?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's it. You know, in the meantime, we're talking about, you know, revamping the White House rather than what needs to be talked about. And I think, you know, going to your point, one of the greatest tricks that they've ever pulled is to label things that really need to be discussed as religion or politics. It's not, it's humanity. You know, whether it's the COVID, you know, the pandemic, whatever it is, it was never political. And with this, it's not about politics. It's the fact that, you know, this is inhumane what's going on. And you mentioned apartheid. One of the bravest, loudest voices at the beginning were the Irish and the South Africans, two populations that have experienced this kind of issue. So if we're not listening to them, then who the hell are we listening to?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I actually, through this conflict, learned so much about Ireland and the conflict, like you were talking about. I didn't know much of that growing up. So this has opened my eyes to that. And also what's happened in South Africa. Growing up, I just didn't know enough about that. But this this conflict in Gaza has really made me learn a lot more. Because you have to read. You just have to educate yourself. You can't just ignore it. And, you know, there's so much distractions in our lives. And we can just, you know, binge Netflix, but that doesn't make you a well-rounded person. You know, we should strive for betterment. We should strive for understanding humanity. We should strive to understand different cultures. And again, that makes us American. You know, I think in America, we truly do have that advantage of being so multicultural and just being able to understand the world at a level that most other people who live in a uniform population don't get the chance to.
Absolutely. Well, before we close off this conversation, is there anything else you want to impart?
No, I just honestly, I feel like I've been talking to most people at work nowadays, and people who have come up with the conclusion that, you know, 60,000 dead and, you know, half of them women and children. I just say thank you for having a moral compass. Like that's the level of expectation I have now the fact that people just have a moral compass. And if that's what it takes for the world to change, I'll take it, you know? Because like I said, something's changed in the last 2 or 3 weeks. Let's continue this momentum where we're doing grassroots education about humanity. And I think that's what's going to change the world. You know, people like you talking about this, who are not scared to back away from this, giving me a voice. You know, I actually asked one of the representatives, how many physicians since October 2023 have been there? Probably 500. So it's probably 500 individuals who can actually speak to what's actually happened there, you know? And only 170 at Nasser Hospital, which is crazy, you know? And yeah, I just really want to thank the people who are speaking up for being brave. You know, we in the West have a louder voice. And I'll have to say it, white men and women have a louder voice than me as a brown American dude. And so I want to hear more voices speaking up about this. Because it's really not a religious thing at this point. It's not an ethnic thing. It's just humanity is just being annihilated, you know? And we need to get back on our feet and learn from history for once. I think at the end of the day, we have to remember that everyone out there who's being killed is no different than your sister, your mother, your father, your brother, your son, your daughter. They're just trying to live a life.